Good afternoon. It's Thursday, the 1st of June, 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me today from 21st Century Wire, Patrick Henningsen. Thanks for being with us once again, Pat.
Great to be here, Mike.
Okay, well, let's get straight into it. We've got quite a bit to cover. And, of course, the first thing to talk about is the BBC election debate, held by the BBC, of course. Patrick, did you watch?
No, actually. I prefer other forms of torture.
So. Okay. Well, okay. So that happened. BBC happened. Lots of people there. Corbyn turned up. But apparently Theresa May didn't. What kind of perspective... Well, she is still Prime Minister. What kind of prospective Prime Minister doesn't turn up to debate?
This is absolutely unprecedented. I mean, so when does a head of state not show up to an election debate for a general election, Mike? Has this ever happened before? Could she not be bothered? What do we know?
Well, two points here. First of all, election debates are a relatively new thing, so they aren't sort of traditional going back 40 years or anything like that. Sort of in the last couple of elections, they've tried to do this, bring British electioneering into American style, you know, that kind of thing. But this is the first time, as far as I know, that a serving prime minister has actually chickened out completely. But if you've seen any of her presentations to the public recently, and of course these presentations not made public, so it's a chosen audience. For example, she was in Plymouth the day before yesterday. Did you know that?
I did not right. know that. If I knew, I probably would have liked to
well,
have gone.
Well, we would have gone, absolutely, gone, yeah. but she didn't tell us, and she didn't really tell anybody.
This is what Hillary Clinton did, actually, throughout most of her campaign, private event,
right?
Invite only.
Yeah. But anyway, so presenting to these chosen audiences, she looks completely out of her comfort zone. This is supposed to be a pro-conservative audience. Generally, they're organizing these events and controlling these events quite tightly, and she's still feeling discomfort. Okay, so she sent her second in command, perhaps, I don't know, Amber Rudd instead, who, you know, her colleagues are all saying what a great job she did and whatnot. But here she is. She was challenged by Green Party Caroline Lucas, leader Caroline Lucas, who said he was asking about the sale of arms to the Middle East. Amber Rudd said, "I'll make no apology for being a government that wants to defend this country. We will make sure that our defence budget is well funded, and we will do that by having a strong economy, and make sure we can do that by having a strong industry."
Is that like the canned answer for everything from this government? Because I think Theresa May gave this exact same answer for a budget shortfall question.
Right.
Exactly the same answer.
Yeah. Right. So then she was then asked about, Saudi and Yemen and so on, and she began to say Saudi has the right. She didn't get to finish the sentences because other people started to interject, but Saudi has the right. What does Saudi have the right to do, Patrick?
I assume she's about to say the right to defend itself, because that's usually what comes after. But I wouldn't exactly call laying waste to your neighbor, carpet bombing it into the Stone Ages, having the right to defend yourself. So I would have liked to have seen her finish that statement, actually. It would have been very interesting to see what she came out with.
Right. So Theresa May, clearly on the back foot, polls showing that the Tory lead has disappeared to nothing. So she's trying to reorient things back towards Brexit again, because when everything was about Brexit, she was apparently absolutely miles ahead of everybody else. But now that these people have brought in other subjects and she's being shown up for what she is, she's losing support hand over fist. So she wants to turn it back into Brexit again. Brexit is the great national mission, she says. She said, "For Britain to succeed, we need to be ready to grasp the opportunities ahead and make the most of every talent and ensure no person or community is left behind." What does that mean?
No child left behind. This is another old recycled talking point. So it seems like the day makeup is wearing thin already, Mike. There's no coalition opportunities in sight.
Not for the Tories, that's for sure.
Not for the Tories. And so the issues are sort of overtaking. The issues of the day are overtaking this government, and they seem to be losing a little bit of control of the narrative.
Absolutely. So then she went on to say, "And as we come together behind this great national mission to make a success of Brexit and the opportunities it brings, we will build a more united country as our shared values, interests and aspirations bring us together. So she's moved from strong and stable to shared values, interests and aspirations. Everything's aspirational. We're now 12 months on from the EU referendum, 12 months since British people voted for a brighter future for our country, 12 months since they voted to leave the European Union and embrace the world. And in 1 week's time, they will have the opportunity to affirm that decision and secure that brighter future by voting for me, Theresa May, to continue as Prime Minister. Did that stir you there, those words? Passion?
Well, the Brexit point, Mike, is really crucial, because I remember sitting here with you a year ago, right after the referendum, and we commented at how it was all very convenient that all of a sudden the Tories took this Brexit position, which none of them had months previously, Boris Johnson or anybody, and that was clearly to sort of garner some UKIP, to peel off some UKIP voters for this. So I think that's wearing thin now. Even the UKIP voters that peeled off and sort of gave some tacit support to the Conservatives no longer believe it anymore, Mike. So the facade is crumbling very rapidly.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's move on then from the election to the Brussels Economic Forum. This is taking place today. And they say that they are the flagship annual economic event of the European Commission. They say they bring together top European and international policymakers and opinion leaders, as well as civil society and business leaders. It's the place to take stock of economic developments, identify key challenges, and debate policy priorities. Sounds almost like Bilderberg.
Yeah, and timed beautifully as well with the Bilderberg Conference, which we'll be covering later in the week.
Absolutely. So, and later in this news program, actually, we'll be mentioning. So the Brussels Economic Forum, they say, attracts 1,000 participants every year. So what are they covering? Fighting inequality in a context of modest growth. The EU economy at 27, towards enhanced cohesion, integration and prosperity. Do these titles make sense?
No, this is kind of a poor man's Davos. Literally, a poor man's Davos.
Right, and the final agenda item for this afternoon is migration, challenges and opportunities for the EU economy and society. So just before we come on to the
opportunities.
Opportunities.
Cheap labor.
Absolutely.
Okay.
But so just before we come on to the keynote from this morning, the keynote speaker from this morning, let's just mention migration, because the Telegraph here pointing out that Spain is now bearing the brunt of a new migrant route. Is this because the Italian migrant route has had some exposure recently, and they're showing the ships going backwards and forwards, and people are starting to ask how this is taking place?
Spain's always had a migrant route, Mike. This was actually before the migrant crisis, the jump off point from Spain, from Morocco to Spain was sort of number one for some sub-Saharan, at least sub-Saharan East Africa, West Africa.
West Africa.
Sub-Saharan West Africa, so Spain was the route.
Yeah.
So that's not a new story.
Well, it's new because of the scale, so it is scaled up now, and they're saying 3,300 migrants in the last 4 months. So it's starting to scale up. But anyway, getting back to the economic conference, the keynote speaker at 10 a.m. this morning was George Soros, and he had a lot to say about Europe, and we're just going to run through his speech because it is worthwhile spending a few minutes discussing it. So he began by saying, before I come to the subject of my speech, I'd like to tell you who I am and what I stand for. I am an 86-year-old Hungarian Jew who became a US citizen after the end of World War II. I learned at an early age how important it is, the kind of political regime which prevails. The formative experience of my life was the occupation of Hungary by the Nazi Germany in 1944. I probably would have perished if my father had not understood the gravity of the situation. He arranged false identity papers for his family and many other Jews, and with his help, most of us survived. And in 1947, I escaped from Hungary. So, but that's only part of the picture, Patrick.
It is indeed only part of the picture. I think he left out a really important part of that story, the latter part of that story. Which is what George Soros did as a youngster. I believe it was working with his uncle, I'm not sure, but under the assumed name.
Yes.
And they were liquidating the property of Jews who were about to be put on boxcars and sent off to wherever, deported or maybe possibly even to camps, I'm not sure, But that was in admitted by him
in his autobiography, and he said this was the best time of his life.
Yeah, this was the time that made him, and you know, so it that's a real important look into the man, his history, and what's made him who he is today, which is an international gangster of sorts.
Oh, philanthropist,
philanthropist, yes. Stroke gangster. Yeah, yeah.
He also mentioned in this introductory paragraph that he was mentored by Karl Popper, philosopher. As Alex Thompson puts it, he was of the generation of Austrian philosophers who first became Marxist and then sought to clothe Marxism in respectable garb. So this is where Soros is coming from. So let's move on through and what he said. Most Europeans of his generation were supporters of further European integration. He said that the purpose of his talk today is to explain what he would like to be working on. He would try to save the European Union. This is the key point. He would like to save the European Union in order to radically reinvent it. So this is a change agent extraordinaire. He's always trying to reinvent things in what? In his own image? Mm. Is that how he views himself?
Well, reinvent them into a form that can be maintained and controlled. Because clearly the current system is spinning, the old model or the original project is spinning out of control.
And he's absolutely acknowledging that, because he says the first objective is saving Europe. That has to take precedence because Europe is in existential danger. But we shouldn't forget about the second objective either. The reinvention of Europe would have to revive the support that the European Union used to enjoy. We would do it by reviewing the past and explaining what went wrong and how it could be put right. And that's what he wanted to talk about today. And then he went on to say that most Europeans of his generation were supporters of further integration. Subsequent generations came to regard the EU as an enemy that deprives them of security and promising future. Internally, the European Union has been governed by outdated treaties ever since the financial crisis of 2008. These treaties have become less and less relevant. He said that the European Union was meant to be a voluntary organization of like-minded states that were willing to surrender part of their sovereignty for the common good.
Or all of their sovereignty.
He said that Brexit will be immensely damaging and harmful to both sides, that the European Union must resist the temptation to punish Britain and approach the negotiations in a constructive spirit. The European Union should use Britain as a catalyst for introducing far-reaching reforms. Mm. So Brexit, in his view, is a reform process.
And who's going to spearhead that? Who's going to get that up and running?
Well, Theresa, of course.
Theresa,
of course.
Our new relationship with Europe, a new deal.
A new deal, yeah. Right. Now, let's just remember Cameron's Best Both Worlds document. Remember that this new deal has already been done, right? And they have a clear idea what the reformed European Union is going to be. He's giving instructions here. He's telling them to stop faffing about, get on with it.
Or else.
He said, I'm a great believer in momentum. I call it reflexivity in my conceptual framework. So he wants to build up momentum. Momentum so strong that nobody can stop it.
In his conceptual framework, I get the feeling this man sees himself as somewhat of a god or a demigod of sorts.
I think that's right. And he said, I can see a momentum developing that would change the European Union for the better. That would require a combination of top-down and bottom-up elements, and I can see both of them evolving. How can he see that? Because he's evolving them. It's particularly the bottom-up elements here. He is evolving those.
He is evolving, and on the top-down, we're talking about Wall Street, we're talking about massive leverage in currency markets. We're talking about massive leverage in trade markets, so top and bottom, as you said.
So then he went on to talk about a couple of the bottom-up organizations, Pulse of Europe, the Pulse of Europe Initiative. I'll show you the website in a second, and Best for Britain. These were two that he particularly cited. These are Sorosite organizations that are there to bring about change. He went on to say, those who care about the fate of the European Union will have to get actively involved. He said, I must end with a word of caution. The European Union is cumbersome, slow-moving, and often needs unanimity to enforce its rules. This is difficult to achieve when two countries, Poland and Hungary, are conspiring to oppose it, so direct threat there. But the EU needs new rules to maintain its values. It can be done, but it will require resolute action by member states and the active engagement of civil society. So that's what he said, and the active engagement of civil society. But Patrick, is it unfair to say that he is civil society? Yeah. I mean, how many civil society organizations does he support?
How many third sector organizations, how many quangos, how many charities, how many change agents is George Soros backing? So this is a seminal speech, by the way, Mike. I think people need to pay attention. He's laid out an absolute agenda here in a way that I have, if you look back in history, this looks like one of those speeches.
Yes.
That's been made by luminaries in the past, that you should really take heed and take note of what he's saying, because we can see what's coming down the pipe.
Absolutely, and I thought it was worthwhile spending a little time on that. So let's just have a look. There is the sort of top, the masthead of the Pulse of Europe website, hashtag Pulse of Europe. Go and look at it. It is a change agent website, usual type of organization. Here's Best for Britain. Stop a Tory landslide. They're getting on the Stop a Tory landslide business, but look at the people that are running this.
This is interesting, the spin here. Vote to prevent extreme Brexit.
So absolutely.
They're already working the margins of this issue, Mike, and forming the nuance. So the nuance will replace an actual Brexit, basically.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, we'll move on to a couple of brief ads. Let's a quick reminder of the mortgage compensation seminar, which is being held on the 8th of June in Birmingham. Get involved in that. Anthony Carlin speaking at that. They're attempting to make the securitization of mortgages issue similar to PPI and other sort of banking scandals.
The new PPI.
The new PPI.
Is coming.
Absolutely. So you can book at simevents.co.uk. That's CYMEvents.co.uk. And of course, media on trial on June the 11th in Frome. You'll be speaking, Vanessa Bailey speaking, Piers Robinson, Robert Stewart, Tim Hayward, and Peter Ford.
And Peter Ford, former British ambassador to Syria, is stepped in at the last minute, and he'll be delivering an address as well. That's going to be an absolutely brilliant event,
yes,
probably.
Absolutely. So, Bilderberg.
Bilderberg 2017, the meeting in Chantilly, Virginia, Mike. What's on the agenda this year?
What's on the agenda this year is Russia, the Trump administration, the war on information, and those are the three main topics that have been identified so far.
So how to stop Trump, Russia, and the internet?
Correct.
Basically.
Correct.
Okay, interesting.
Correct. Now, amusingly enough, as a number of people were pushing out, the Bilderberg meetings.org website, the official website, was hacked for a short time. Mm-hmm. That's a shame. We get a clue, perhaps. It never ceases to amuse me. It continues, just the rhetoric in various mainstream outlets about Trump. So this is the sort of return for all the Hillary emails scandal, mm-hmm. right? So they're now really concerned that Trump is using his personal mobile phone handset. He's giving out the number to all kinds of world global leaders. Vladimir, give me a call on my own handset if you wish.
No problem.
Here's my number. And they're saying, oh, this is a massive security breach.
I don't see why, because it seems like the NSA is listening to, they've got recordings of everything anyway.
Well, exactly.
But that's the Daily Star is very sort of pro-liberal establishment newspaper based in the Middle East, English language.
Yeah.
But yeah, it echoes.
They're Lebanese, aren't they?
They're Lebanese, but it really echoes what you're going to see in The Guardian and The Washington Post. So it's the same sort of news organization.
So anyway, Trump clearly viewed as a threat by the sort of establishment, the political and industrial establishment. So he is an agenda item on Bilderberg. Did you see who was attending this year?
What names popped out to
well,
you, Mike?
George Osborne.
George
Osborne is attending.
Is he the new editor of the brilliant newspaper?
The Evening Standard.
The Evening Standard, that's
That's
it.
Why he's attending. He's no longer Chancellor of the Exchequer, but he is now, he still goes.
He must be running a journalism course there.
Well, that's quite possible. And also Kansu Karnabel, Kamlabel, is that how you pronounce it? Washington Bureau Chief for Turkey's Hurriyet newspaper.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
People like... Marcus Igeus there, of course, if we're thinking about British people. So the usual suspects that have been there year on year. Mm-hmm. We've mentioned Marcus Igeus before, ex-Barclays, currently, I think, working for Press Association.
LIBOR scandal.
Absolutely, LIBOR scandal, and the usual suspects there. Yeah. So we will have more on that tomorrow. I think we're going to try and get Mark Anderson to join us for a short time tomorrow to bring us up to speed.
The important thing is we have an article posted at 21st Century Wire looking back at who attended and then what positions they were thrust into immediately following the Bilderberg meeting. So everyone's looking for the rising star, who's basically going to springboard from Bilderberg into a prime ministerial position or a head of state, for instance, or head of a major corporation. So,
and that's on the front page of 21st Century Wire at the moment.
That story, who benefits from Bilderberg.
Okay. Super. Okay, Patrick, let's move on to Macedonia. Now, we mentioned Macedonia earlier this week because they've just joined NATO.
This is the most important place on the map right now in Europe, and possibly in the world, Mike, right now is Macedonia. If a fire starts in the Balkans or Europe, it will start here.
Right. So on screen, we've got their new prime minister. He was voted, the way it works in Macedonia is the parliament votes for who this prime minister is going to be. So he won the vote, and he's a social democrat leader, Zoran Zaev. So that was late on Wednesday that he was voted. 42 years old, and as I say, 120 seat parliament, 62 votes he got. What do you think is going on here? Well, let's just have a look and see what Jens Stoltenberg's response to this was. I spoke with Prime Minister Zaev today and congratulated him on his new responsibilities. We agreed on the importance of addressing urgently needed reforms, including on good governance and the rule of law. So here we have a puppet who's been placed as Prime Minister, taking instructions from Jens Stoltenberg and others. A Sorosite puppet, in fact.
Yeah, no, this new prime minister in Macedonia is George Soros' man. Make no mistake about it. And so a campaign was run to basically push out the competition in favor of this person. And some crazy promises were made to shoehorn this guy into power that they'll adopt Albanian as the official language of Macedonia. So again, creating another half Albanian non-state or something like this in the Balkans. So there's that, and plus to sever the relationship with Russia. And that's really what it came down to in this election.
Somebody in the chat box there saying, I thought Macedonians were trying to get rid of Soros. What happened there?
Maybe half. This country is literally split 50-50 on this issue of good relations with their neighbors like Serbia and also Russia.
And in fact, we mentioned last week, absolutely 50-50 with regard to whether to join NATO or not.
Absolutely 50-50. And it would probably be less than 50-50 if people knew the real motivation behind NATO wanting to expand into Macedonia, which, of course, very few Macedonians will ever get the real story on that, if truth be known by the international English language media. But there's another thing, Mike. It's the Balkans is the last mile of the Silk Road, and China is pouring a tremendous amount of investment into the Balkans, into Serbia, into a high-speed rail system from Belgrade to Athens, and from Budapest to Belgrade to Athens via Macedonia, possibly. And so if the Balkans are able to join up in any kind of economic cooperation, and including Serbia, and with Asia, this is going to be not good.
And that's why it's so important that Macedonia is now a member of NATO. And do you see this move? Because, the way I read Stoltenberg's comments, they're tantamount to a threat. And do you see this move under the surface to blow up that region in civil unrest and potentially civil war? Is that because of this threat of Macedonia and that region becoming part of the Silk Road project?
If that's what it takes to pry them away from Russia and China, or to pry the Balkan states like Macedonia away from good relations with Serbia, then they will do that. They will instigate color revolution, civil unrest, possibly kick off another war like they did in the 1990s.
And is this what Pepe Escobar is getting at with this article in Sputnik? A great article,
it
Jihad 2.0, The Making of the Next Nightmare.
This is a great article, and he also features quotes from Dr. Osi Yezeshi, who spoke at AV8 a couple of weeks ago, and who we also have hopefully on one of our programs very soon.
Yeah.
But this, you know, people have to remember as well, this is nestled right up against Kosovo, Mike. And Kosovo is, and Escobar underlines this, they're turning it into one of the world's prime bases for ISIS and the recruitment of terrorism. You've got a former head of the KLA, who I think is the head of the Kosovan autonomous quasi-state, Mr. Hashim Thaçi. But we've also got the MEK in Albania. You've got the MEK in Albania. This is the Mujahideen Akek from Iran. This is being used by the West, by the neocons, to hopefully overthrow the government in Iran. So it's just like a terrorist enclave that the West and NATO is trying to basically build in there, plus the weapons coming from the Balkans into Syria and into the Middle East. So they're definitely using it as a launching pad for aggressive operations into the Middle East and possibly Asia as well.
Yeah. Okay. RT here is reporting or asking the question, who is funding Britain's terrorists? Sensitive Home Office report may never be published.
Yeah, may never be published. And so for some reason, unbeknownst to us out in the plebisphere, David Cameron commissioned a report while he was prime minister. It could end up being one of the most useful things he ever did as PM about terrorist funding sources to radicals and extremists in Britain. And of course, front and center in this report, there were a lot of connections, I'm sure, to Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. So Theresa May was privy to this report during her time as Home Secretary. So she would be very much in the know. But of course, her government has had to bury this, because here we see her in the previous slide there with the Saudi officials there in the kingdom. And of course, probably negotiating an arms deal, Mike, sale of British arms and defense procurement items into Saudi Arabia alongside the U.S. Everybody's making money. It's all good. So who cares about the terrorism in Britain or the extremist cells running amok? Because there's a lot of money to be made. Isn't that really what it comes down to, Mike? Would there be any extremism or terrorism if the money was cut off? Probably not. So it really comes down to that.
Yeah.
Turning a blind eye to it.
Okay, well, complete change of subject then. This is the Financial Times. Global debt woes building up to a tidal wave. Now, this echoes an article that was published a few weeks ago in Handelsblatt, 3 weeks, I think it was, ago, and basically saying that we're starting to look at a 2008-style debt crash. More acknowledgement in the mainstream media that this is coming. Many commentators have been warning about this for quite a long time. So here we are. Global debt woes are building up. The tidal wave. U.S. companies have added $7.8 trillion of debt since 2010, and their ability to cover interest payments is at its weakest since 2008. And they're also pointing out consumer debt has reached levels that are really unprecedented. They say the threat of a looming crisis is not solely down to the absolute volume of debts. At least three things make the situation especially precarious. First, debt, particularly dollar-denominated, is becoming more expensive. Second, the ability to repay debt is under strain in countries where revenues stem disproportionately from commodities. And also, they point out that growth in the United States and Europe is very slow, and that any recession would cause a nasty shock to the system. And, you know, there's kind of a, you know, we've been saying this for 4 years, sort of. In fact, we've been saying this since 2007, 2008, that they didn't solve the problem, that they're just blowing up more and more bubbles. They will never learn, and until we as a general population learn to hold these people to account, we're going to keep facing these types of disasters.
It's also not the case, Mike, that we'll never learn or they'll never learn. It's that, as you know, and many other people who've studied the financial crisis know, this is done by design. Because with the debt crisis comes all sorts of emergency solutions that need to happen, like mass privatization, for instance, selling off state assets for pennies on the dollar. If you go to a third world country, the country's carrying a lot of debt, Mike. national debt to international banks like the IMF or international institutions, right? But the people themselves don't have a large amount of consumer debt. You go to the West, and the people, we're carrying a huge amount of personal debt, each individual, and the country is carrying as well a large amount of national debt.
Well, right. No, that's that, what you just said is important, because I think we've got to get the terms right. And this word national debt is bandied around to mean government debt. National debt is the debt that everybody owes. And it's not just government debt, it's corporate debt, it's personal debt, it's mortgage debt, all kinds of debt. You know. And when you look at the national debt as a whole in the UK, and we're, what, about 900% of GDP, how is that repayable?
Yeah, it's not. So it's going to lead to some very extreme solutions.
Yes.
Yeah.
So Zero Hedge then reporting that hedge funds are piling into gold at the fastest rate since 2007. And of course, they're not really piling into gold, Patrick. They're piling into gold futures contracts.
Not real gold.
Not real gold.
Paper gold.
So you know, they think that anything that is sort of gold-backed is a safe place.
But they're taking long positions, Mike.
But they're taking long positions in futures contracts, which, and of course, the hedge funds don't ever want to take delivery of a physical commodity. But the point is, if they ever needed to take delivery of it, the gold isn't there to cover the claim.
MF Global.
So yeah. So this is another example of a bubble. I mean, the gold market is an unbelievable bubble. Mm. But all is not well at the Bank of England, because bankers don't strike, do they? Well, it seems that they do, because the Bank of England is facing a strike. They are holding a ballot on whether to, in fact, they're holding the ballot today on whether to hold a strike, because they're protesting below inflation pay rises at the Bank of England.
Oh, I see.
It's a hard life for them. I don't know what the average Bank of England person gets paid.
I'm sure it's not a living wage, Mike.
Depends on.
I'm sure they deserve more. At least they think they deserve a lot more.
Well, they do. Perhaps
stressful.
Perhaps they're looking at Mark Carnegie's salary, because he's receiving £480,000 per year.
Plus.
Plus £250,000 accommodation allowance.
I knew there were some perks in there.
Yeah, but he has done the decent thing and declined any pay rises since he joined the bank.
That's
very
rather,
generous of him.
Rather
isn't
generous
it?
Of the. Our Canadian friend, but a 250 grand housing allowance, that's not bad, is it?
So there you go. They're having a ballot. The ballot closes on the 21st of June, and the strikes are likely to start begin in the summer, late summer, early autumn.
I'd love to see the scab breakers on this busting through the picket lines at the Bank of England.
Yeah.
Who's going to do that?
Well, indeed. Okay, and well, let's get on to more serious issues. Europol has set up a new website called Stop Child Abuse, Trace and Object. You look confused, Patrick.
Trace and Object.
Yeah, well, basically, they are wanting to help to trace victims of child abuse. They say they're launching a new website to trace anybody that's been affected by the problem. Well, what are they doing? They're publishing some photographs like these.
Handbags,
shoes, sort of corners of rooms. They're basically publishing sections of images that probably involve the abuse of children, in the hope that that some of these venues or some of these items might be identified. I find it difficult to know how a pair of shoes, which is probably one of a million pairs of the same shoes that were bought and made and sold, could possibly help. Handbags and so on. I'm not sure how they could possibly hope. They say that they're hoping that people will be able to identify the origins of items, for example, a logo on a bag or a shampoo bottle. I mean, this just seems nonsense to me. And alert the police through an anonymous tip-off or through social media. They say, we're convinced that more eyes will lead to more leads and ultimately help save these children. They say that the crucial thing is to identify the origin. They say once the origin of an object is identified, we will inform the component law enforcement authority of the involved country to further investigate this lead and hopefully speed up the identification of both the offender and the victim. In many of these cases, the key breakthrough has been established through a small piece of information, such as identification of objects in the backgrounds of the image that provide a final vital clue to the investigators. Now, Pat, I'm loath to, in one sense, to criticize, because I'm sure that these guys are probably doing the best that they can do. But this, to me, the business model here with people trafficking and child abuse, the business model is almost identical to the business model used in drug trafficking. Mm-hmm. So a small amount of money is pushed into this type of initiative, an amount of money which is absolutely inappropriate and incapable of actually making any real difference.
Well, are you going to get quality leads, really? Because it says right there to generate more leads. But are there going to be quality leads?
No, I believe all they're going to get, just like with like we saw with Madeleine McCann, for example, they're going to get inundated with phone calls and information that's going to tie up investigators for months or years, and in fact, it's going to achieve nothing.
So what you're saying is the way to tackle this is how, if you want to tackle big drug cartels, or if fight organized crime on that side, you need to apply the same tact, which is to go straight for the top. Or try to break the syndicate at the elite level, the cartel level.
Yes, we've got to understand what's driving the trafficking, and we've got to deal with that. This is just dancing around the edges of the problem, and in the meantime, people are making billions in the center. So, you know, it's a good business model if you're in there, but it's a pretty despicable one.
Mm-hmm. We'll see how effective it is.
Yeah. Well, that's it for today. Thank you for joining us.
Great to be here, Mike.
Thank you for joining us. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Slightly shorter program today. Tomorrow will be longer because we will have David Scott and we'll also have Mark Anderson on the program. So we'll see you then, 1 p.m. as usual. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.